tell you, of course. Well, I mean, I have to add an anecdote. I was recently invited to a dorm. Professor Gumbel, tell us how it really was to be at the 1930s. So in that sense, I could simply ask Sasha how it really was. Whatever story the winter tells. But reading his CV is interesting in the sense that one gets an impression of adding the fact that it's headed from one institute of the Academy of Science. All of a sudden, he's not a teacher of philosophy. He's studying right out of all places. I mean, I don't know anything. It's something about intellectual style. Which in Germany sounds like, but I don't know, that this is even more intensive than I couldn't. I mean, it was so interesting that I just didn't manage to fall asleep, which was a good thing because we were sitting at a table which was smaller than this table, and it was only three speakers. And to this is pretty good.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, friends. First of all, it has nothing to do with the matter of this seminar. Please, if you want to ask a question, immediately interrupt me. Don't store your questions till the end of the seminar, please, or even till the interval. Do interrupt me and ask your question. You know, it is particularly important because the subject of my two seminars is utterly recondite. Not at all mysterious, not at all enigmatic. But first of all, my dearest friends, I implore you, forget, try to forget all that you more or less know about Buddhism, because this is not about Buddhism. Yes. This is not about Californian Buddhism, Buddhism in Greenwich Village, Buddhism in Greenwich in London, but a piece of real Buddhism, which is not at all nice. More than that, which is a mortal enemy of all that is nice. So, nobody must say, ah, darling, how interesting. It is not interesting in this Californian, Greenwich Village, or any other way like that. Let me repeat it. Most emphatically, the subject is dry, sometimes dull, and utterly recondite. Recondite in the sense of it's very difficult to grasp. It is very difficult to, as it were, understand on the way towards or by the way, you know, and that is why I would like to start with few words about what I'm going to talk to you about. This is a Buddhist philosophy of thinking or of thought and consciousness, as we find it in the texts of the supposedly, well, 5th to 3rd century BC and the commentaries. More than that, first of all, please, few words about those texts. Yes. Oh, sorry, I forgot one thing. It is because of Sepp's introduction, but the thing, first of all, let now me introduce myself in not generally, but in the sense of these two seminars. The thing is that my position as regards Buddhist philosophy of thought or Abhidharma, try to remember it. By the way, amazingly enough, but Abhidharma is semantically a bit similar to metaphysics in its composition. Abhi, the Sanskrit prefix abhi, and the Greek meta and dharma and physics, it is very clear parallel. That is that which is to be studied, to be investigated after. But after what? After what? After that which we call Buddhism. Buddhism as a way towards liberation, Buddhism as one of the world's great universalist religions, and it is associated in our poor minds with Nirvana, with a silent Buddha, with a sort of flower of Zen Buddhism, and the other antique shops from San Francisco to Iowa, yes? Nothing of the kind. Abhidharma is very dry things. Very dry collection of very dry things. Very difficult to understand. That is why I call it from the very start recondite. So, recondite, who am I here? The first point about myself, I do not represent anything here, apart from my own thinking about thinking. Full stop. I'm no professor here, I'm no Buddhologist here. I'm talking about Buddhist philosophy of thought, Abhidharma, but I do not represent the Abhidharma. I simply present, humbly present it to your attention. It's a totally different thing. And in doing so, as I have already mentioned in a very schematic summary, I am more plagiarist than follower. Plagiarist in the sense that while speaking to you about the Abhidharma, I cannot help being influenced by the very style of the Abhidharma. It is above my forces. But enough about me. Yes, a very dull matter. Now, about Abhidharma and Abhidharmic texts. After I please to remember the five main points about Abhidharmic texts. The first, all the Abhidharmic texts were transmitted in the Buddhist tradition only at the beginning, only orally. It was an oral tradition. It's very important to note. And even in the latest commentatorial Abhidharmic texts of the 6th and 7th century AD, that is approximately 1,000 years after, however hypothetically, the origin of the Abhidharma was placed somewhere probably in the 3rd or 4th century BC, they were put to writing in Sri Lanka first of all, then in Burma undoubtedly, where the Abhidharmic tradition persisted till today. And that's it. Now, a few more words about the Abhidharmic texts. And what is extremely important. Next point. Abhidharmic texts, they were not considered sacred texts in Buddhism. It's very significant, ladies and gentlemen. Why? The term sacred texts usually what was used only in the description of the texts which were regarded conventionally, of course, as Buddha's own words, Buddha Vachana, whereas all the Abhidharmic texts were considered the words of Buddha's pupils, of pupils of Buddha's pupils, of pupils of the pupils of Buddha, pupils, etc., etc. So, that little collection of the texts, which is preserved as the third part of the Pali Canon, in Pali language, well, we say in English translation, it is the smallest collection of texts, but not exceeding, together with the commentaries, not exceeding 8,000 pages. Other two connections, Vinaya discipline and Sutta, were much larger, yes. So it is a small collection of the texts, approximately half of which have already been translated into English, French, and some other languages. Now, and one more important thing about the Abhidharma. because I'm very afraid to forget something about the epidemic text. It is the dullest, probably, part, but it is necessary. So they were not sacred texts, so, and they were purely oral texts at the beginning, but now what is very important. In their genre, it is it's highly significant that they never were regarded by Indian Buddhists as universal text. Now, few words about that rather uncanny idea. What does it mean, universal text? Each culture, each textual culture, has a special group of texts, which I, for convention's sake, call universal. That is a text which we may say express practically all of that which all other texts in one way or another could or may express. So, to give you an example, for instance, we may say that in India at that time, the universal genre was genre of sutra, and most of the Buddhist texts were, as it were, sutras. Sutra is a text relating the history of one or another appearance of the Buddha, of his conversations with his pupils, yes, etc., etc. And the universalism of those texts means that all existing topics may have been included in those texts, not necessarily about Buddhism, not necessarily about Nirvana, about anything. We may say that, well, of course, it's rather risky, but now, what would you suggest, what kind of, what genre of text can be, for convention's sake, taken as for universal? Novel, of course. Novel, which assumed at first polyfunctionality, but then became the most, shall we say, encyclopedic text of our culture. And speaking of the Buddhist text, of course, the text of Abhidharma were absolutely opposite to universe. They were very specific, and that is why for very many years I could not understand why it is so difficult to explain one to one the Abhidharma. And then, after having read some old commentaries of the second half of the first millennium AD in India, I realized that to explain the Abhidhamma to ancient India was as difficult to explain the Abhidhamma to us now. Because it was a special group of texts which was not meant to be easy for understanding. So, now, okay, I think it is enough about the text. So, now, the subject. Philosophy of thinking. And about the Buddhist philosophy of thinking and consciousness, ask ourselves, but what did not do answers in the text? The first answer is nothing. Nothing. Thinking and consciousness cannot be defined. Because it's the only context in which they can be defined is the context of another thinking and consciousness. Yes, it goes without saying. So it is the first answer. The second answer, what is thinking and consciousness? Everything. The first is nothing. The second, everything. Now, let us jump to everlasting, sometimes extremely boring discussions nowadays about whether there is such a thing as thinking. So one of the, in my opinion, or one of the sharpest thinkers in the 20th century, thinkers on thinking, Wilfred Bion, said in his in his introduction to his Brazilian lectures, thinking, well, thinking is highly hypothetical. More than that, he said, if I am asked, is there any possibility of thinking? My answer will be, I'm quoting Wilfred Bion, no, ladies and gentlemen, not a possibility, but probability. Now, the second quotation, yes, I may refer to Gottlob Frege. Well, what is thinking? What is thinking is an object of thinking as any other object of thinking. Nothing remarkable. And of course, the answer given by Heidegger, you know, thinking is thinking on being. Particularly in his series of lectures, the Bathheit und Denk, yes, you know that. Interesting, not very convincing, but interesting. And finally, we are coming to the last of the philosophers who tried to say something very general about thinking. It's an American philosopher, you undoubtedly heard of him or even read him. It is John Searle, who said, thinking, well, I do not know. But I'm absolutely sure that the act of my thinking now and here is absolute and absolutely independent. And irrespective of other opinions, of other perceptions. But I consider it as non-dependent on any other thinking or any other circumstance. Very brave, yes? Well, enough of introduction. So let me come to the Buddhist, I cannot call it definition, characterization of thinking in the Kashyapa Parivarta Sutra around 3rd century AD. Of course, in that sutra we do not have a direct answer to what is thinking, or least of all, whether there is such a thing, in double quotes, as thinking. The Buddha said to his most favored pupil and secretary, Ananda, what do you think, Ananda? Is it difficult to think about Nirvana? Forgive me, but I'd rather refrain from defining Nirvana, because it is a kind of a fodder for everybody in the Western and parts of this world. No. So, what do you think, Ananda? Would it be difficult to think on Nirvana? Oh, the Lord! Oh, Lord, it is difficult, it is very difficult, it is very, very difficult to think on Nirvana. It is almost impossible. And Buddha said, but Ananda, it is very difficult, it is very, very difficult, it is almost impossible to think on Nirvana, but billions times more difficult, trillions more difficult would be to think about thinking, Ananda. Ananda, he was the best pupil, therefore the most modest pupil. He said, oh Lord, I do not know. And then Buddha said, even the great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the past, present and future do not know what. Isn't it funny? Because for one very simple reason. In the Buddhist classification given in the Abhidhamma, thinking is not a normal object of thinking. It is a kind of exceptional object of thinking, or we may say rather special object of thinking. And only on some levels of thinking it is possible to think about thinking. All other stuff, like nirvana, like final liberation, like karma, like reincarnation, all that Buddhist theater in the West, yes? It is difficult to think about these things, but still possible. While to think about thinking is impossible, even for the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Now, why is that so? Okay, now we are coming to the first very important point in the Abhidhamic teaching. Don't forget to ask questions, please.
Yeah, may I ask a question?
Yes.
Which verb do you refer in
the... Sorry?
Which verb do you refer in the Pali text?
You know what? It is very interesting that very often, particularly in the Buddhist texts of Ratnakuta Kalashate, the Buddha addressed Ananda, Kim Manyate. Manyate. Yes, not, but sometimes, of course, Chintate, undoubtedly. A sort of a regular term, of course, for thinking will be Chitta, Citta. For consciousness, vijnana in Pali or vijnana in Sanskrit, and for mind, manas in Sanskrit or mana in Pali. But in that conversation in Kashyapa Parivarta, well, Kim Manyate Ananda, what do we think? But of course, philosophically, the most important term remains citta. Citta, yes, undoubtedly. No. Now, why is that so difficult? So we are coming to the first point in the Abhidharmic teaching. Thinking or thought, the way it is very difficult to express in English as well as in any other language, including Sanskrit and Pali, yes. Because thought or thinking is not instead, they offered, instead of is, they offered the verb to emerge. Thinking is not thinking, is emerging. And that is why you cannot say there is thinking, there is thought. That is, you can. Well, for convention's sake, yes, for conversation. But properly speaking, thinking is not. It emerges. It does not exist in any state other than in the state of emergence. This is very, very important point. In other words, each and every thought is regarded as emergence of thought. More than that, by derivation, we have such formulations, particularly in the Theravadin text, commentatorial Theravadin text of the second half of the first millennium AD, and more than that. So, the first, all thought, or in plural, all thoughts emerge, but then all that emerges is even for that time, this assertion was sounded so bold so controversial that we have a lot of critical texts, not only from outside, that is, on the side of heterodox Hindu philosophical critics of Buddhism, but in Buddhism itself too. But you know another thing about which I forgot to tell you, I have a very bad. Another thing is that the Abhidharmic tradition from the very start, probably because of its oral character, and of course you know that oral texts are preserved much better than the written. You know about that, yes. Because written texts can be destroyed by climate, yes. By fires, yes. By volcanoes, yes. While oral tradition, or the Abhidhamic oral tradition, happen to be one of the stablest oral traditions in the world. And even after introduction of writing and then printing, the oral Abhidhamic oral tradition continued to coexist with the transmission of written texts. Isn't it amazing? So, now, so, we may say that what is called thought is in fact emergence of thought. It is that which emerges. But what the hell can we do with this? It is not a kind of a linguistic game, because it was meant very, I would say, almost materially. Now, then the question arises, what does it mean? One thought, another thought. What is the difference between one thought and another thought in terms of emergence of thought? Oddly. Now we are entering the indeed very recondite domain. The thing is that all thoughts, in the sense of emergences of thought, all thoughts are discrete. And the time of an emergence of thought is, according to the latest Sri Lankan Buddhist scholars, unfortunately spoiled by the modern science, the time of emergence of thought is 164 billionth fraction of a second, which is called in Pali Kana, in Sanskrit, kshana. And the whole teaching of the momentary emergence of thought is called Kshanavada, or in Pali Kanavada. Vada corresponds to logia, or logic, momentology, really, Kshanavada. So, but at the same time, I'm continuing with this point. At the same time, absolute discreteness of an emergence of thought was asserted. That is, at a given moment, only one emergence of thought occurs, and then another. You may call it the next, if you want.
Would you discreteness? Does this then mean when in the Abhidhamma tradition it's always a punctual emergence? It's only one thought, or could one say that a sequence of thoughts?
Sequence of thought is a sequence of emergences, of absolutely
plural,
discrete,
right?
Emergences,
okay,
and to that we'll come to in the
so there's
next
no
seminar.
Overarching emergence of
yes, thing. Yes, undoubtedly, but for a start, you know, of course, the first, it is a series of emergences, and between each two emergences, there is with the same momentary duration, 164 the billionth fraction of a second. So we may say like something like that. Try to imagine one emergence, non-emergence, the next emergence, non-emergence, the third emergence, non-emergence, etc., etc., etc.
May I add one question?
Yeah.
As you're saying, and I don't know how.
Yes.
So would one then attribute
what? But now it would be a bit difficult for me to answer your question as a yes or no. But the thing is that it was also stated that nowhere in the universe that duration of one emergence, it cannot take any other emergence inside itself. More than that, it was asserted, and I say it was asserted probably as early back as in the 3rd century AD, it was asserted that what we call time exists only as a series of units of thoughts. Outside emergences of thought, there is no time. That is what we call time. Emergence, time of emergence of thought, or time of non-emergence of that interval, which is also intrinsically connected with emergence of thought. Yes, please.
Wittgenstein characterizes thought as in Wittgenstein's discussions of thinking, that thinking is uncaused, that thoughts aren't
uncaused.
Yes.
That is outside causality. So, splendid. Let me explain Buddhist conception of causality as regards a conception of emergences of thought. That is, one of the Buddhist philosophers from South Atlantic school somewhere in the 3rd or the beginning of the 4th century A.D. used to say, but what we call causality in Sanskrit hetuvada, literally causalology, yes, what we call causality, but in order to say that A causes B, I'm quoting now, we have to, between A and B, in order to, shall we say, bring to fruition that phenomenon of causality, it cannot take place in a moment, within that shana. Causality takes more time, according to those philosophers from South Atlantic school. So, we may say, speaking metaphorically in Sanskrit, vachanamatra, well, as a way of speaking, well, we may say that a thought or an emergence of thought has no cause. And then Vasubandhu, the author who spoke about that, well, but it will be one, it will be a kind of extremist assertion, he said. We may also say that the first emergence of thought has no cause. One extreme, another extreme. Emergence of thought cannot have any cause, but only emergence of another thought. Yes?
could you comment on the relationship between perception and thinking in this tradition? A very brief comment. I mean, perception involves thinking, or is it a different thing?
Yes, perception, projection in Sanskrit, was regarded as one of the cases of thinking. But I do not want to disappoint you, ladies and gentlemen, but all other mental and psychical modalities within the framework of the Abhidharma teaching were regarded as varieties or versions or more exactly cases of thinking. Why? And it is clearly expressed in the text, because whatever we speak about is thought. So irrespective of whether we have, while speaking of emotions, of will, of representations, you know, irrespective of whatever kind of the object we are thinking about, that object exists only through our thinking. And in fact, again, it is a very interesting point. For instance, I'm anticipating it. Well, I did not want to go ahead because it is one of the points of my second seminar. Of course, sometimes it may sound even a bit funny, but it was no pun for those robust Buddhist masters of old. No, when they said, while speaking about other people's thinking, don't forget that other people's thinking exists, or shall we say, instead of exists, emerges only through your own thinking. And your own thinking, now it is getting difficult, ladies and gentlemen, your own thinking can be perceived only because you are thinking of your own thinking in a secondary, reflexive way. That is, one thinking does not exist if it is not seen, I'm simplifying, by another thinking. Even or not even, and first of all, if it is your own thinking, that you can say, unlike John Searle, you can say that I am thinking, because that I am thinking has already been reflected through your thinking over the next level. You understand it? Or shall we put it even in a more uncanny way? My own thinking, poor René Descartes, my own thinking exists in double quotes, exists only either as a result of or in the process of my own thinking on my own thinking. Is that very difficult or still comprehensible?
I mean, as far as my modest mind is concerned.
By the way, step. Now you didn't know that you were quoting from another Buddhist text of the 4th century, because it was a problem of easiness. Do you remember what René Descartes reiterated? He said, yes, how strange. In comparison with our outside world, our inner world, is very easy, said Descartes. You remember that? He repeats it 6 times. That is, for me, it's much easier to talk about my thinking, my wishes, my emotions, my sensations, than about any external phenomena. But, yes? Now a little, but absolutely necessary, digression, ladies and gentlemen. The masters of the Abhidhamma insisted on a radical difference between own thinking about my own thinking and my own thinking about other people's thinking. Yes, sir. An ordinary person cannot perceive other thinking. So an ordinary person cannot say he thinks about somebody else, but he can say, yes, like John Searle, for instance, I think. That is absolutely evident for me. And if you do not believe me, it is your business. It simply means that you cannot perceive other people's thinking, yes? It is a kind of circular discussion. So, an ordinary person can directly and immediately perceive or think of and if somebody says about himself, I am thinking, please do believe me. Yes, and then you must believe him. Edgar might have asked, oh, are you sure, sir, that what you are doing is thinking? I doubt it. I doubt whether you are able to think, yes, really. But you know, it is a late Germanic witticisms, yes? And still I like that in Heidegger, yes. Because even in saying this, he was very serious, by the way.
And I think there are two layers.
Yes.
As everything is decadent in our time, we cannot even think. And that's kitsch, right?
Well, in a way...
No, but then there's another one, when he comes up with his own characterization. I like it because it is not a definition of thinking.
Yeah, a characterization.
And he says, and when he has this formulation, I cannot translate that, which I like, just because he doesn't say emerges, but he has...
Yeah.
You have to embrace it with your attention. And whether you manage that, to embrace it with your attention...
Then you do think. It's not
then you do
not.
Think. And that is an interesting thought.
Yes,
Whereas the Kulturkritische, that, oh, you know, we are also untergekommen, as you would say, run down.
Yeah.
Okay, that's kind of... Forget about it. That's as bad as point. But
Now, the next point is the point B. But... Cause who... But... Still, I can say, for instance, I'm looking at you, and I think you are thinking now. According to Dignaga, I am saying that because I deduce your thinking, unlike my own, which I perceive immediately and directly by way of projection, but speaking of anybody's, oh, she looks as if she were thinking, yes? Or, for instance, looking at that notoriously ugly sculpture of Rodin, thinker, the acme of tastelessness, thinker, yes?
You removed it from campus just
now. Yes, it's very funny, isn't it? But still, you know, for Rodin, it was very serious. So, I can say that somebody else thinks, deducing his thinking from some external signs, marks, lakshana in Sanskrit. So, it is possible now. But there are some persons who, unlike me, a normal, average thinking or speaking Buddhistically, a normal average thinking in brackets, or more exactly non-thinking person. Because average thinking in Buddhism is equal to non-thinking. because again, it's very interesting. By the way, I'm terribly afraid of diversion, but in the Abhidharma, you can see that if somebody thinks, if Mr. A thinks like Mr. B, it is the first sign that Mr. A does not think. Because thinking can be only absolute in the individuality and discreteness of its emergence. Difficult to understand. From a sort of Abhidharmic point of view, only one, but mind it now, only, you are not yet tired, frankly, no. Only one person, or sorry, I take my words back, please, only one thinking, not thinker, please, only one thinking can think. Two thinkings, thinking equally, mean non-thinking, because it cannot happen like that. Is it understandable? Only one case of thinking is authentic.
In any given time?
In any given time, yes. In any given time, or shall we say, it is much better to say, in any given situation. Now, okay. Even in its Husserlian interpretation is definitely does not exist. By the way, in quite a few ways, Abhidharma was a very anti-Husserlian. Very anti-Husserlian. Yes. Yes, please.
You told us not to ask quite about the whole difference between thinking and everything that appears to be physical. Doesn't that also exist from instant to instant?
Abhidharma. Undoubtedly, because every other thing emerges only within the emergence of thought as one of its objects.
Well, I perceive something.
Oh, please. Sorry, your name?
Stuart Sargent.
Stuart. Yeah, you know, what traces, but in its absolute actuality. No, because the very idea of traces implies time, yes. No? Yes, undoubtedly. Immediately. You know, what is extremely curious here.
I was thinking that as a way of getting to our perception of thought, because we are aware of,
yes.
You already, the instant has already passed by, but there is a trace that you...
Yes, it is treated in the Abhidharma, but shall we say, in the next section, about the traces of more than that, you know, the trace in the Abhidharma assumed the term aftertaste, or after, instead of afterthought, aftertaste. A lot of food metaphors. This one very subtle point, ladies and gentlemen, about that. So we have already dealt with me thinking of my own thinking. So you have to believe me. Yes. Because I have direct perception, and me thinking about your thinking, you don't believe, you should not believe me, because I can only deduce your thinking in your external, etc. But here it is asserted that there are those who are able to directly perceive other people's thinking as their own, because their own thinking has already been radically, yogically transformed in the process of two main yogic activities, bhavana and dhyana, or dhyana in Pali. So those with yogically transformed thinking, they are able to directly perceive not only their own thinking, but other people's thinking. Now, the last point here, well, the last sub-point in this point, it is very curious. In the case of perception of another thinking by those whose thinking has already become yogically transformed, it is stated that still it is possible only if thinking, other people's thinking, is perceived by your thinking, it is possible only due to absolute synchronicity. Thinking that thinks about other thinking must be absolutely synchronous with other thinking. Yes?
Does that mean that with my own emerging?
God, you got the point, because there can be no two thoughts within the same emergence. You're absolutely right. Sorry, your first name is?
Anna.
Brilliant, Anna. Yes? Brilliant.
But, not to undermine.
Please don't undermine.
No. We would never do that. But if they can
imagine to emerge, within that kshana, within that...
How can one then talk of synchronicity?
Oh, well, that is another point in which some tarantikas were particularly interested. So, one part of the school of tarantikas said, well, okay, that kshana, that moment, 164 million fraction of a second, yes, well, don't forget, please, that it is ancient Indians who invented the word positional calculus and zero, yes, but, you know, so, according to one section of that school, however small fraction of time, it is still time. According to the majority of the temporologists in that school, no. One moment, one kshana of emergence of, or non-emergence, between two emergences, cannot be regarded as time. It is not time.
Each individual unit is not.
No, each individual unit is. Let us make our short interval, but you are not tired, yes? Tell me frankly, yes. So, 5 minutes interval.
Am I not to judge from the faith?
yes, but you know, first of all, I am an exemplarily tactless person. Well, but not only that, you know. So, 5 minutes
okay.
Interval.
So reconvene at 23 and 64 million.
Yeah, it's no more than that.
The best professor in the world right there.
It's
incredible. We know that. It's physical. Time itself exists. Without that. No, there's no time as we know time. There are about two different types. But there is a time that cannot be destroyed. That's what she says. Go ahead, you just said time.
There's one.
Yeah, but that's limited. That's limited. I don't know. Well, that's a science thing, that's why. So we take it physically. This time, but time is not physical.
You're calling it so obvious.
I know that much from how you leave. You know,
it's a big mess. It's not like we can go to the movies. There's even no cattle. I mean, it's just nothing.
Mm-hmm.
No. And I sometimes have those. You meet somebody, and after 4 days, you have talked more. So that's fine.
They could be used in this discussion in Chinese. They're interchangeable, sometimes they're not. Here's the channel. That would be, it would take a lot of Kshanas to get that together. But we can translate the same English word, which shows you that we don't have adequate tools for talking. Yeah. Well, we have consciousness, and that's one of us who are thinking. I mean, one reason we know that other people are thinking is because we cannot imagine a conscious being not thinking. Equate thinking with consciousness. It's probably easier to imagine a chair thinking than it is to imagine not thinking. I don't know if that's actually. I mean, that's really, I mean, unless they talk about it, it's a stupid question.
64 million seconds. Would you get time for 2 cigarettes?
You don't have to be there for yourself. Actually, the thing that brought me in is a particular aspect of the 11th century stop thinking. When you think of it, how do you not think? And you realize that you can think without having an opinion. Then you realize that it's very good. But I don't think we can imagine not thinking. Yeah. Right.